Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee. It's great to see everybody here this morning. Happy Mother's Day. It's a very special day, and I appreciate you all coming out, notwithstanding the, or maybe because of the special day. Good. So today, if you saw the email on Friday, today we talk about dreams. And this is a wonderful topic in general. You know, it's always fun to talk about, you know, altered states of consciousness, especially when there's a spiritual and Kabbalistic connection. Today is also Lag BaOmer, which is the 33rd day of the Omer. Happy Lag BaOmer. I would say it's a minor Jewish holiday, but I don't say minor to minimize it. And I don't say minor because it only applies to kids like, you know, under bar and bat mitzvah. No, it's a minor holiday because it's not a biblical holiday and one in which, you know, we don't do work, but rather it's a holiday, and it's very interesting because it's a pretty widespread Jewish holiday, even though it's a minor holiday. Nonetheless, it has a lot of Kabbalistic meaning. In fact, the whole thing is really about Kabbalah. Today is the anniversary of the passing of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Who was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? He lived around, I would say, 1900 years ago, and he was one of the students of the great Rabbi Akiva. He was known for his incredible scholarship as well as his incredible knowledge of the secrets of the Torah, i.e. Kabbalah. He was one of the greatest mystical scholars in history and one of the greatest mystical teachers in history. He is the author of what is probably the most famous work of Kabbalah, known as the Zohar. Zohar is the book of, literally Zohar means radiance or light. Zohar is a work that he authored, again, 1900 years ago. It was written down by his students. Much of some of the deepest secrets in Kabbalah he taught on the last day of his life. And he gathered his students around, and they were all gathered in his house, and at a certain point, there was a big fire that surrounded the house, and everyone ran out, except for two, his son and Rabbi Abba, who was one of his greatest students. And he said, now, the fire, it was a real fire, but it was also a spiritual fire. It wasn't burning down the house. The fire was symbolic of the power of the light of the day. And he began teaching the deepest secrets of Torah, and he said to his son, you memorize them, Rav Abba is going to write them down, and together you'll review them with the other disciples and subsequently. Anyway, passed away that day sharing these profound secrets. He said, by the way, in that final communication, I don't want to pass away having held on to any of these teachings and then have to be taken to task in the other world. Why is it that you kept stuff to yourself and you didn't share it with everyone else? You know, you had this wisdom, you had this divine wisdom, and you held on to it, and you took it with you. You put it in your pocket. So he said, it's the last day of my life, I'm going to share it. Happened today. Before he passed away, he said, this is my Yom Hilula. This is my day of celebration. Don't mourn. Don't mark it as a day of sadness and sorrow. Celebrate it as a day of joy. It's incredible. Day of his passing, before his death, he says, celebrate my life, celebrate my accomplishments, celebrate what I'm teaching you today, and this day forever should be a day of celebration. And for 1900 years, we've been celebrating it. Already, I don't know, 500, 600, 700 years ago, you have rabbis that write accounts of what went on in Israel by his resting place in Meron. It's in Israel, to this very day, there are bonfires. Why bonfires? Because of the fire that surrounded his house. There was a fire that was around his teachings on the last day of his life. And so therefore we commemorate Lag BaOmer with bonfires and we go out into the field. It's a wonderful celebration. There's music. There's kids play with bow and arrows. In fact, we're taking our Hebrew school kids. I'm working on that this morning. Taking our Hebrew school kids to the park today. And they're going to be playing with bow and arrow. Obviously, safe bow and arrow. This is kid-friendly bow and arrow. This is Rich's Variety Store toy version of the bow and arrow. This is not like real legitimate, you know, warfare bow and arrow. But it's, you know, there's a beautiful reference there with the bow and arrow that says that during his lifetime there were no rainbows. In the lifetime of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, there were no rainbows. Why? The rainbow is a sign of God's anger, so to speak. God's displeasure. God says, I know we think of rainbow as being such a beautiful thing. Look at the rainbow, it's so beautiful. But the Torah says there's one biblical source of the rainbow. After the flood, remember? God says to Noah, I will no longer destroy all of mankind. And what is my sign to remember this promise? It's the rainbow. Which means that when you see a rainbow, it's almost like God is reminding himself of his promise. Which means without the promise, you with me on this?
Yeah.
He might otherwise destroy the world. So
can't he be reminding us that it's good?
He's reminding us, yeah, but if you promised not to retaliate, right, and here's the sign that I won't retaliate, and then you show somebody the sign, you dangle the sign, it usually means that you were about to retaliate, but you reminded yourself that you promised not to, and here's the sign of the pledge. So when we see a rainbow, in fact, that's why this is a Jewish custom, not to say, oh, look, there's a rainbow. You say a blessing over a rainbow, blessing to God. We don't bless anything else. You say a blessing, even food, by the way. You don't bless the food. I should just clarify. You say a blessing to God for giving the food, right? You say a blessing. So we say a blessing when we see a rainbow, saying, blessed are you, God, for keeping your covenant. But it's not like for creating the beauty of a rainbow and all these awesome colors. That's not the blessing. So again, not that the rainbow is a terrible thing or whatever, but in praise of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, the Talmud says that during his lifetime, God never got to the... He was such a tremendous tzaddik, the world... He lifted up the whole world that it never got close. So there was never a rainbow in his lifetime. So to commemorate the non-rainbow, we pull out the bow. We're not going to create, turn on the sprinklers and get the sun to shine at the right thing. We're not going to do that. Right? And that would be too, like, working against it. So traditionally, again, this is an ancient tradition going back hundreds of years, maybe even 1,000 years. I don't even know when it started. That the kids, you know, they play around with a bow and arrow. Again, safe bow and arrows. We'll do whatever it is we'll do today. Bottom line is, it's a wonderful day, a day of celebration, a day of joy, and it's a day associated. And the joy is because on this day, he taught the deepest secrets of Kabbalah. So it's very appropriate that we're gathered here today on this day, Sunday, May 14th, 2017, Mother's Day. And Lag BaOmer to study Kabbalah. So, with that, I say welcome. It's a long welcome.
So, where was yes. he actually living?
He was living in the land of Israel.
So, but he wasn't living where he was in that city.
I don't know if he was living there or not. I know that's where he's buried, yeah. Meron. In Israel, last night into this morning, non-stop party. Just absolutely lit. Hills are just bonfires and concerts. Oh, and by the way, there's a custom not to get a haircut in between Passover and Shavuot, except for Lag BaOmer today. So a lot of parents bring their kids, their three-year-old boys, that turn three after Passover and weren't able to get their first haircut. Some of the custom not to cut the boys' hair until they're three. But if they're turn three after Passover, so you don't do haircuts, so they push it off to Lag BaOmer, and many parents take their little boys to Meron, and they do haircutting there. And it's like all these kids getting their first haircuts. It's a very cute thing. I've never been there myself for this, but I've seen the live streams. They have videos and everything. It's a wonderful celebration.
Can it fall on Shabbat?
It cannot fall on Shabbat. No. We crack that code to make sure that it doesn't happen. I've never, so I say that with confidence, I don't remember ever experiencing Lag BaOmer on Shabbat. And it's possible that's one of the that it just can't be. There are certain things that can't happen.
Because so many days after.
Well, no, the great sages that instituted the Jewish calendar, these were unbelievable scholars, not only in Torah, but also in mathematics and astronomy. They set the calendar again, for the last few thousand years, they set it to go on forever. And to be precise, there's a 19-year cycle of years and where the sun and the moon kind of like, they go out of sync and then they come back every 19 years. It's exceptionally precise. And the holidays themselves, the calendar, the annual cycle is set up in a way where, I think it begins with Rosh Hashanah. It says, Lo Adu Rosh. Rosh Hashanah cannot fall out on Aleph, Dalet, or Vav. Which Aleph is Yom Rishon, is Sunday. Dalet is Wednesday, the fourth day. And Vav is Friday. Rosh Hashanah, the first day of Rosh Hashanah, can never fall out on a Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday. And there's a reason for that, which is kind of technical. But the bottom line is that they set up the calendar that that these holidays should never fall. You don't have to fix it on an annual basis. It's not like you have to tweak it. Okay, wait a second. Uh-oh, look what's happening. Rosh Hashanah has fallen out on a Sunday. Let's bump it a day. You don't need to bump it. It's already been pre-bumped. The way the calendar works, it was set up once, and it goes. It's unbelievable the way it works. It's a complicated calendar. Again, there's leap years. It's complicated, and it keeps the moon and the sun in sync every 19 years. Bottom line is, holidays can't fall out on a certain day. I believe Lag BaOmer, because of that, just cannot fall out on Shabbat. Another holiday, yeah. What was I going to say? A day that cannot fall out on Shabbat is, I don't know, there's something else that cannot fall out on Shabbat.
Anyway. It's interesting because some of the high-end watch companies are considered, there's like seven different calendars, you know, Judeo-Christian.
Right.
So anyway, some of the high-end watchmakers have only set up maybe one or two calendars on their watches because it's so incredibly expensive to adopt another calendar.
Yeah.
Into the mechanics of the watch.
I can't imagine a watch working with the Jewish calendar.
What about Israel?
It would be impossible. I have no idea what they do. I don't know if they do that.
Yeah, so they have to retool, and it's incredibly expensive.
I don't know. I know one thing, that the Jewish calendar is a marvel. And I don't even know all the mathematics involved in it, but I just know that it's incredible. Okay. Oh, and by the way, if I'm not mistaken, see, I don't know enough about the mathematics to know how cool this was, but I know at a certain point a few decades ago, NASA, they were with their space exploration, they figured out something about either the sun or the moon, some precise calculation they were finally able to come to, and it was within a fraction of what Maimonides writes about, you know, 1,000 years ago. It's just the incredible wisdom that they had then. This is Jewish wisdom, and you should know, in general, I'm always struck by this, the world had a lot of wisdom. We sometimes think that we're the first, like, smart people. But you look back at what they built back then, without, you know, machinery, how'd they build all that stuff? Unbelievable. And we want to be cynical, and we say, well, how many people died, they just threw people into support stuff. I don't know. They had complex systems. I think at a certain point, a lot of wisdom was lost, like in the Dark Ages or whatever. There were a lot of incredible innovations that came through. Anyway, so today is Lag BaOmer, and today we talk about dreams. So what is a dream? What happens when we sleep? So some you might think that when you go to sleep, you're in a state of, you are not in a state of consciousness. So consciousness, that state, is when we're awake and aware. And then when we sleep, it's not a conscious state, right? No consciousness. However, Kabbalah and science says that medicine says it's not true. It's not that when we sleep, we're not conscious, but rather, more precisely, it's an altered state of consciousness, which means that we have multiple states of consciousness. There is the wake consciousness, and then there's the sleep consciousness. But it's also a state of awareness. So what's the difference? When we're awake, and so now I'm going to mix in Kabbalah. When we're awake, we have the powers of the soul operating in an orderly fashion. So as we've discussed many times, the soul has 10 powers, 10 signature powers, Chachma, Bina, Dat, which are the intellectual faculties, wisdom, understanding, knowledge. Then you have the seven emotional powers, chesed, gevura, teferet, netzach, hod, yesod, malchut, love, discipline, compassion, ambition, humility, communication, and leadership. So you have the seven emotional powers. When we're awake, these have a shot, at least, of working in an orderly fashion. Likewise, our other faculties of the other powers that we have, which are sight and hearing and speech and touch and smell, all of those powers are also working in an orderly fashion when we're awake. Usually, they work in an orderly fashion. Could be they don't, right? It could be, yeah. But typically, at least we have a shot at them working in an orderly fashion when we're awake. Doesn't mean we always make sure that our mind is controlling our heart, or that we're seeing the things that we should be seeing and hearing, listening to things that we should be listening to. Nonetheless, we have a shot at that experience. What happens when we sleep? Kabbalah says like this. When a person sleeps, typically, unless they're on a long flight, or pulling an all-nighter at their desk, if you work for one of these tech companies, or maybe some other companies, or you're in graduate school, right? Typically, you're sleeping in a horizontal position, which means that the inherent structure of the human being is altered. Doesn't mean that you don't have the same components that you had before when you were awake, but it means that there's a fundamental shift into how they are. And you can see it visually. So whereas when a person is awake, they're standing up, or even if they're sitting, the head is higher than the heart, and the heart is higher than the leg. When a person sleeps, everything is the same. We would say, to use a food analogy, it's one big chalent. You know what a chalent is? A chalent is that Shabbat stew that has, you know, what are the ingredients? How do you make a chalent? You throw everything in. No, but really, what do you put in? Yeah, that too. Yeah, put it in. It's fine. Does this go in a chalent? I don't know. Try it. Find out. We'll see you tomorrow. Chalent, the stew, the Shabbat stew. You should know the chalent is a very holy food. I'll get back to this in a second, why it's holy. Anyway, the chalent is everything's mixed together. So if you're a potato, if you're a barley, if you're kishka, which is vegetable, if you're an onion, if you're a sweet potato, it doesn't matter. It's all in a stew. It's not like there's no hierarchy in a chalent. Everything's mixed together. When we sleep, our whole being is a chalent. It's all mixed up. Which means that the head is equal to the heart. Or, more precisely, the heart is equal to the head. And the feet are equal to the heart and to the head. There's no hierarchy, there's no superiority. At the same time, we don't see and we don't hear. Doesn't mean you can't see and you can't hear, but it means that these powers of the soul are not operating as they typically operate. So typically, when you're awake, when we're awake, we're looking at things and we're taking them in and we're analyzing it, and we're also doing a very good job at filtering. You know, when you walk down the street or when you drive in a car, there are so many things that you could see potentially that you need to block out in order to see in a healthy way only the things that you need to see. Does that make sense? There's so many stimuli that you need to block out. Likewise in hearing, if you heard every single sound that there was, it would drive you crazy. You would hear the creak. You hear everything. Oh, not that creak. Not around here. If you find a creak, let me know. That would be very, I don't know. Not right. Not in the hood right here. I don't think.
Low water.
Yeah. There you go. Not too far. I mean, like, in the building. We may need to call some help in if there's a creek suddenly flowing through it. Okay. So, creak.
So if you're hearing,
good. If you hear everything, You're going to go meshuga. It's too much. So the what we're able to do is filter, as first of all, hear the things that we need to hear, filter out the things that we don't need to hear, and that way, you know, the things that come in are healthy. I mean, hopefully, and the things, okay. When we're sleeping, we don't have control. We're in an altered state of consciousness, which means it's not that we're not conscious. We are, but our consciousness is in a very different state. We're not aware of the things that we see typically. We're not aware of the things that we hear typically. Rather, there's a different awareness. What is a different awareness? Kabbalah says it's the koach hamadama. What is the koach hamadama? It's the power of imagination. So we always have the power of imagination, even when we're awake. We can imagine something. It doesn't even have to be in the form of a daydream, but it's almost like the idea of imagination, which is not just thought. It's kind of like creative thought, but also unconstrained thought. Thought that's not bound by the structures, the boundaries of what is the norm, what makes sense. Imagination means I can imagine something that doesn't make any sense. It's hard to do that when we're awake because our rational mind, because the mind is on top and the mind is very logical, the mind says, whoa, you can't think like that. That's crazy. So the mind is always trying to put boundaries, borders on our imagination. So even as we try to think outside of the box, the mind says, sure, it's outside of the box. Within this safe box that I've created, you can think out of the box. So the mind will create multiple boxes. The mind is really good at this. The mind is smart. That's what the mind is, right? Literally. So the mind says, here's the deal. I'm going to have a box. You're not going to know about that box. I'm going to create another box that you'll know about. And that, you'll think, that's your box. So when you think that, oh, you're going to think outside the box, sure you will. You'll still be within the borders of the larger box. I'm not going to let you get out of those because then it's going to be unsafe. It's going to feel, the mind will feel threatened not having that type of control over your consciousness. So the mind, again, consciousness is not the same as rational thought. Consciousness can also be when we sleep, which is not rational thought. But the rational mind says, I want consciousness. If I'm in control, I want consciousness to be contained and safe. Make sense? Of course it does. So the mind tries to keep everything safe. It's like when you print something, if you've ever printed something online, maybe a postcard, maybe a business card, whatever it is, so they have different borders. So you set up your file to print whatever. Let's say, you know, I don't know, a 5x8 postcard. You set it up 5x8. No, no good. You have to create a little bit larger, and they make sure the text, so that the actual the file has to be a little bit larger than that, and the text has to be a little bit smaller than that. It all has to be in a safe area, because if they cut it and it's too close to the side, you're... Bottom line is you have to have safe boundaries. The mind creates safe boundaries and borders. When we sleep, the mind loses its power. The mind loses its control. Remember, the mind and the heart now and the feet, every part of the body is on the same level. It's on the same level. It's very, the hierarchy is gone. So the mind no longer has control over the consciousness, over what is being thought about. The rational part of the mind does not have that control. And it's then that the imagination can truly run wild. Unchecked by the rational mind, the koach hamedame, which is the power of imagination, suddenly has free reign. And we know when we dream, suddenly you can think, suddenly you can have these thoughts and this awareness, this consciousness of things that are absolutely impossible. You mix time and place and people and just everything becomes mixed. And it doesn't make sense, but in a dream it makes sense. Totally made sense. Then you woke up, you're like, wait a second, that didn't make any sense. So how did it make sense? It made sense because the imagination is not limited by those rules. The imagination part of the mind is not limited by the rules that we typically put up. The mind says, look, if something cannot be, then you can't think about it. You can't imagine something that cannot be. Without that, it's almost like the parent in the room. Without the parent in the room, imagination goes wild.
So I have one question and one thought. One, what you're really saying is when you're asleep, the brain, which is the filtering valve.
Yes.
It's the filter.
It's the filter.
Essentially, it's taken out of the picture.
Correct.
And that means that what's left in the picture is, well, your consciousness, which is not your brain.
Right. Which is not your rational brain, exactly.
Which is the amazing thing, that our consciousness, our core consciousness, i.e. consciousness that's not rational, is not in the brain at all. So the filtering valve is out. I think that's an awesome picture. And the other thought that occurred to when you're supine is, in a way, what you've done is you've elevated the heart. So instead of being pushed down, you've now elevated. So the imagination, to me, seems like it's coming from the heart and the non-rational soul resides more in the heart.
It could be, yeah, that's the more instinctive, it's feeling, instinct. Yeah. We know dreams have a very powerful effect on our emotions. So it's very possible that it's connected, in a closer way to that. I think the key is that the rational brain is not in control. It's not doing the filtering. So it has so the imagination then has the ability to have a lot of expression. That's what happens when we sleep. Now, what that means spiritually is it has a lot of spiritual significance. And it's for the good and not for the good. In other words, sleep is used as an analogy to, usually used as an analogy to a state that is a spiritual state that's not ideal. The wake state is typically considered to be ideal in that the mind controls the heart, and the mind and heart control the feet and the hands, in other words, control actions and behavior. So what our mind tells us is the right thing to do, that's what we're excited about doing, and that's what we actually do. So that's typically a healthy hierarchy. And sleep is understood to be a time when anything can happen and anything goes and things are altered and the impossible becomes possible in a negative state. That's typically how it's understood. We're going to flip it here a little bit and show how there's a major positive of sleep, but you should know right off the bat that although sleep has this incredible allure, nonetheless, sleep is typically, in Kabbalah, is typically used as a metaphor or an analogy for a less than ideal state. In fact, there's a pivotal chapter in the book of Esther that begins chapter 5 with Balayla Hahu Nadada Shnas HaMelech, which means on that night, the king's sleep was interrupted. The king Ahasuerus, so part of the story of Esther, the book of Esther, is the king can't sleep. And he calls in his assistants. They don't have assistants. It's a king. His servants, whoever it is. And he says, read to me. And they read the book of Chronicles that he wrote, his diaries, whatever. And they come up to the story of Mordechai who saved his life and he was never repaid. And he says, tomorrow morning we're going to repay him. And then Haman comes along and he says, you be the one to show him honor by leading him on this horse through town. The next thing you know, the whole story shifts where Haman is where Mordechai is elevated and Haman is demoted, and that shifts the whole story. And Kabbalah points out that how does that pivotal chapter begin? By Laila Hahu, on that night, Nadadash Nas HaMelech, the king's sleep is interrupted. In other words, What creates a state of danger, a state of chaos, is sleep. And when the sleep is interrupted, or when the sleep is ended, and when the person wakes up, that's when Mordechai is Mordechai, and Haman is Haman, and right is right, and wrong is wrong, and good is good, and evil is evil, and the good guys win. When can it be that a Haman who's evil might, God forbid, be victorious over a Mordechai who's righteous? It's only when you're sleeping. When you're sleeping, anything's possible. In a dream, anything can happen. So it's seen as a negative. Again, we're going to see it toward the end of the chapter how it's a positive, but the initial setup, the initial approach to this dream exploration is that the dream state is the not ideal state, where since it's the imagination that's running wild, anything can happen, even something negative, even something illogical. So, truth is good and God is good and doing a mitzvah is the right thing. So how can we do something the opposite? Oh, we're dreaming. Yeah.
This just does not make sense. First of all, it sounds like the mind is actually a dictator, making sure that anything that it does not agree with is filtered.
Yes.
But sleep state allows imagination, sensitivity, awareness, all the things the mind didn't allow to be brought into the consciousness of
yes.
sleep. And we wake up with an awareness very often of things that are on our mind that we couldn't think of when we were awake.
True.
So I don't know where this is going.
Okay, so here's the thing. What you said, everything that you said is 100% true. And that's why sleep does have benefits, and sleep is wonderful, not only because of the rest, but the sleeping and dreaming has incredible power. At the same time, Kabbalah, what I'm saying is not at all to contradict that or to differ with that. Everything you said is true. At the same time, when Kabbalah uses the analogy of sleep, typically it's using it as an analogy of a disrupted state of the human condition in a negative way, where instead of a human being knowing what's right and doing what's right and following the right, you know, the right guidelines, a person is all mixed up and in a negative state. That's considered, that's typically how Kabbalah uses the dream state. Not that dream and sleep is inherently negative, or that most of the time it's negative. Not at all. What I'm saying is that it uses this as an analogy to understand how it is that a person can do something meshuggah. How can a person do something illogical? Do something harmful? Person loves someone and they harm them. And you ask them before, do you love them? Yes. You ask them after, do you love them? Yes. So what happened? We call that a dreamlike state. In other words, it's a state where something that didn't make sense happened. A person did something that didn't make sense. That doesn't mean that sleep and dreams are negative. It means that that's how Kabbalah, that's a way that Kabbalah, that's an analogy or metaphor that Kabbalah uses to explain when things are disrupted.
Yeah, but they do this bad thing. I'm thinking about a man killing his brother. So
that's really bad.
Right?
Yeah.
He's conscious. He loves his wife. He kills her. It's a bad thing. He says it was a bad thing.
Okay.
Where does sleep come into this?
Because it's like temporary insanity.
Well, but that's...
I'm with you. It's an extreme example. It means like this. A person. I'll give you a more subtle example that because that's an extreme example that I can relate to. Some more subtle example is, you know, a child goes over to their parent and says, a child wants to ask the parent a question, and the parent says, you know, wait a second, I'm doing something. And what are they doing? They're doing something. I don't know, whatever. They're, sending an email or texting, huh?
Driving.
Whatever. No, driving maybe is a safety issue, but doing something that is, in the moment, seems very important. But when you look at it with a bit of a broader view, with a little bit of context, you say, you know, is this work or is this thing, is it really more important than my kid? Probably not. So that's an example of, and I think everyone does this, whether a parent, not a parent, everyone does something like this where you put priorities, you put things that are not so important in front of things that are more important. Why? Because in the moment it felt more important.
Okay.
I don't know why. In the moment, it felt more important. But Kabbalah will push the issue and say, well, wait a second. If you know that this is more important than that, how did you do it? Why? How did you put that thing above the other thing? And the answer is, because although you knew that this was more important, nonetheless, at that moment, you were schluffing. That you weren't focused, you weren't thinking along those terms at that moment. You allowed instinct, you allowed imagination, you allowed excitement, whatever, to get the better of you. Or the pressures, whatever it is, you allowed other forces to get the better of you, and you weren't using your rational mind that says, this is more important than that, and I need to be careful with this. So that's an example where we might say that a person is sleeping. And when a person wakes up and they say, wait a second, what did I just do? My child is crying, my child is devastated, and it's because of this I could send this later, or you know what, so what if they don't get this communication from me? Who cares? My child is more important, my child is the most important thing in my life. Person wakes up to that reality, and then the behavior changes. So sleep is used as a way to kind of allow us to understand how things that otherwise don't make sense in that moment. Now, that doesn't mean that sleeping by in and of itself is a negative state, etc. God forbid. Sleep is a positive state. Nonetheless, we use it as a way to express or to explain how sometimes negative states can come about. Now, what we're going to do here today is look at the core question that we raised last week, which is, if a person inside, at the core of their soul, if a person is absolutely dedicated to God, dedicated to something greater than oneself, so why is it that we don't always feel that? You could talk about this in a relationship. Somebody loves someone, and they would do anything for that person. Why is it that they don't always feel that? Why is it that sometimes you can go through hours, days, weeks, even months, and not feel that love that would come out, God forbid, if there was a serious challenge. If there was a challenge, God forbid, right? An illness, whatever it is. So that love, that absolute bond would come out. But in the typical day-to-day stuff, you're not feeling that powerful, essential connection that transcends, you know, everything else. Why not? Last week, we made the daring declaration that the reason is because, on a conscious level, we're distracting ourselves with other things. Because we're distracting ourselves with other stuff that's not in sync with the way we feel on the inside, that does not create the space for the inside feeling to come out. If we were a little bit more transparent on the outside, the inside, the core love, would have a space to come out. In other words, because, speak about a relationship, because on a conscious level, the words that are being spoken are not as sensitive and loving and caring, and the actions are not as, you know, not as loving and connected as they could be. Therefore, the deeper love that transcends all of that stuff doesn't have space to come out either. In other words, at the core, there's an unbounded love. There's a pure love that transcends all considerations. That's a selfless, dedicated, completely egoless love. And it's there. So why don't I feel it? Don't feel it because on the outside, I'm not speaking first person, but one, right? On the outside, one is not doing the things that are... In other words, even in a rational way, a person is not doing the things that are conducive to that inner feeling. Even the logical forms of that expression. Does that make sense? I think I said it more complicated than it needs to be.
Allow that to occur because you're being bombarded by
It's really creating space. It's really clearing out. Right. So it's clearing out. There's so many things that get in the way. It's not. See, the real brilliance of what we said last week and what we're just quickly reviewing here before we jump into the new stuff is it's not just that we have this core love that gets covered over and we're trying to remove the cover. It's more subtle than that. There's the core love that is by definition at the core, so it's by definition it's inside. Then there's the outer layer of, and that's the typical interface that we have with the other person. That's how we typically interact with them. The question is not, is the core covered? The question is, what does that interface on the outside look like? How are we speaking to our loved one? What are we doing for them? Right? How do those interactions look? If those interactions are hurried and distracted and complicated, whatever, then what are the odds that that core, powerful love that is inside is going to come out? In other words, if those outer community, so there's connecting on us on an external level, and then there's connecting on a super deep level. We all have that deep connection inside, or the capacity, assuming that we have that with the other person. The question is not, is that deeper connection happening? The question is, what does the external connection look like? What does the typical day-to-day communication look like? If that is in a healthy, loving way, then that creates, like I said last week, it's like the light bulb and the opacity or the transparency of the cover of the light bulb. If I'm putting a light bulb into, and I cover it with a cement block, there's no light. There's no light. Not that the light is not there, but I didn't create space for the light. I'm not creating any translucency for the light to come through. But if there's that transparency or translucency, then the light can shine through. The question is, are our outer interfaces, are they opaque or are they transparent or translucent? He doesn't speak about human relationships here, at least not immediately. He speaks about, in the text, we're speaking about our love and dedication for God. The premise is that each one of us has a soul, and a soul is a piece of God. And therefore the soul, by virtue of its essence, absolutely loves and is dedicated to God, not because it wants anything in return, but because that's who it is. That's its identity. Its identity is, it's one with God. It loves God like a child loves a parent. Healthy child loves a healthy parent purely and unconditionally. It's not like, I love you because you got me the Xbox. That's not the thing. It's I love you because, it says in the Talmud, a child will give up his life or her life for a parent. We know that a parent will give up a life for a child, but a child, a healthy child to a healthy parent, it's a selfless love. Absolutely selfless. Unconditional. Right? Speaking about Mother's Day, this could be a message to all the kids out there, right? Don't only give the flowers to your mom today because you're going to ask her for something tomorrow or tonight. Right? The love is unconditional. Whether it's from the parent to the child to the parent. But for us, from us to God, because we're God's children, right? So God is the source and we're emanating from the source. The soul at its core loves God. We said in the previous chapter, two types of love. One type of love is conditional. What do I get? I love you because all the stuff that you're giving me, so as long as that happens, I love you. When that slows down, I may not love you so much unless I know that I can get more. But that's like, you know, it's a conditional love, and I only love the part of you that's giving. I don't love you. I love the giving part of you. It's not you. Whereas the second part of love, the second element of love, second dimension of love, which is the core of love, is the soul's love for God that's unconditional. It's not about God creating life and bestowing life and creating a beautiful life and giving us health and sunlight and oxygen and water and all of these wonderful things. It's not about that. It's I love God. The soul loves God because God is. Just because of God, who God is, not because of what God does. We all have that inside. But then a person might think, so how come I don't feel it? Where is it? Where is that unbounded, that boundless, that 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 just absolutely powerful love for God. Where is it? It's inside. How come I don't feel it? Wait a second. Are you speaking nice to God? On the outs, on the external communication. You have that on the inside. You're wondering, why don't you feel it? Why don't I feel so excited? Wait a second. Are you holding the door? Are you coming home on time? Are you speaking nicely? Are you being respectful? Are you taking out the garbage? I know I'm mixing relationships now. It's all part of the challenge, right? In a human relationship, you want to feel the deep love? What are you doing on the outside? Are you doing the little things on the outside? Because that keeps, that creates, again, the light bulb. That's the translucency that lets the big light go through. If that's opaque, you know, if two people are grumbling at each other, you're not going to suddenly feel that core love. I mean, unless, God forbid, something big happens. But that's not a conducive situation. So when it comes, again, bring it back to God, because that's really the focus of this chapter. The question is, on a day-to-day, am I creating some time for God? Am I speaking to God? Am I praying 5 minutes a day, 10 minutes a day? Am I thinking about God? Am I doing a mitzvah? Am I putting, if I have extra change, do I give a little tzedakah? Charity. Am I doing a mitzvah? Am I helping someone else in need, which is a mitzvah obligated by God, right? Am I doing these things, the little things in the relationship that are more surface, and one could say, well, those are not the big things of love. I'm waiting for that big, you know, that sense of total dedication to God. You're not going to feel that, he says, until you do the little things. So it's the little things on the outside that create that space. What happens when we don't have the little things? What happens when life is so distracting? When life gets so busy that we don't have time for God? We don't have time. You got to wake up. We go to work. We're inundated by the pressures. We're trying to make some money to support ourselves. We come home. We're hungry. We're tired. We eat. We relax a little bit. You know, we have hobbies and whatever. And that's it. And that cycle goes on. We don't create time. Forget the deeper stuff. We don't even create the more external, the basic time for God. He says, you know what that's called? Sleep. That's called sleep. That is a state of sleep. Not that sleep is inherently no good. Sleep is beautiful. But in this context, an analogy for that is sleep. Where what should be priority, what should be important, what should be seen and heard and understood is not seen and heard and understood, and instead, our days are filled with other things. Asleep at the wheel. So let's jump into this right now. We are on page 68. 68. Seeing and hearing. However, it's always great to start the text with however. It assumes that we know what was said before. It's been a week, right? So I try to do a decent job of recapping a little bit what we spoke about. What he was saying before is that when you're awake on the outside, when you're doing the things for God on the outside, then you'll feel the powerful, you know, just that atomic love for God on the inside on an essential level. Again, you'll feel that on the inside when you're doing the little things on the outside. However, when the revealed faculties are asleep, when you're sloughing at the wheel. You know, I was looking up some sleep stuff. And I found studies that have shown that people can fall asleep without even knowing they fall asleep.
While driving.
Between 3 and 30 seconds, person can fall asleep and not know that they've fallen asleep. In fact, they've done tests.
If they knew that they were
going to
fall asleep, they
would
fall asleep.
No. They don't even know that they have fallen asleep.
It's like a brownout.
It's what I'm saying is, you can fall asleep, and it could be so short that when you wake up, you'll have thought that you haven't even fallen asleep. They've done studies where I don't know how they did it. I'm trying to remember. I saw the study, and I don't remember how they did it. But they got people to these very subtle states of sleep, not deep sleep, like very quick and subtle, and they asked them, did you sleep at any point in the last, few minutes? No. But they were sleeping. for short amounts of time. No. They didn't do this while driving. They did this in a controlled... Again, I don't remember how exactly they did this. But the bottom line is a person can sleep without even knowing that they're sleeping.
But it occurs. It occurs while driving.
Oh, yeah. You know, when, many accidents happen like that.
Fatigue,
sure.
And it's kind of like a brownout. You know,
it's very dangerous.
Still upright.
Yeah. Know, and, they said people can sleep like this with their eyes open. Eyes open.
But you're and, not and you're not...
That's why sleep, you know, getting into the whole, like, what is sleep? How we started today. Sleep is not eyes closed and dreaming necessarily. It's an altered state of consciousness. Your eyes may be open, but you're not seeing, you know, the way you normally see, and you're not understanding the way you normally understand.
They probably, you know, you could study it with anesthesia, too.
Maybe they gave people some doses of, I don't know how they did it.
Because
I forgot
they say, for example, hearing is the last sense to be lost, in the hierarchy.
Interesting. When you put someone out.
Yes. However, when you reverse it, interesting. It's the first sense that comes back.
The hearing. That's very interesting. That is very interesting. Okay. We're going to get into seeing and hearing today. Okay, seeing and hearing. However, again, when the revealed faculties are asleep, and it could be for even a short amount of time, but when your revealed faculties are asleep, in other words, what are revealed faculties? It's the everyday interaction stuff. As in the statement, I am asleep in exile. Which means, there's a verse that says, Ani Yeshena. Song of Songs, chapter 5, verse 1. Ani Yeshena, I am sleeping, I'm asleep. And it says in Zohar, what a wonderful book to quote today. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, in his work, the day of his Hilula, the day of his celebration today, day of his passing. So in his Zohar 395a, I'm taking this from footnote 94. So in Zohar, he explains that what does King Solomon mean when he says, I am asleep? What does it mean? Begaluta, in exile. In a state of redemption, then we're awake and everything is the way it should be. In galus, in exile, and yeshen, I'm sleeping. He says, and also during natural sleep, what happens is the visual, auditory, and intellectual faculties of the soul lie dormant. This is the key. So what is sleep? He's describing sleep as being a state where three elements are compromised. They don't disappear. It's not like you don't have them anymore, but they don't operate in the way that they typically operate. It's an altered state of operation. What are the three things that he mentions? Visual power, auditory power, and intellectual power. So you're not seeing the way you typically see. You're not hearing the way you typically hear. Doesn't mean you can't hear while you sleep. You can hear, but you're not processing. It's not working in the same way. And until... But see, that's the thing. It's like Alexa. It's always open for the key word, right? Mom, dad. Oh, how can I help? Hello, Siri. Yes, I'm awake now. Yeah, I wanted to wake you up at 5 a.m. because then wish you a happy Mother's Day. Well, no, that's not how this works. Wait a second. No. Okay, so three things he says are compromised. Visual, sight, hearing, and intellectual faculties, that's the one that I mentioned before, our mind that typically puts boundaries of logic doesn't work in the way that it typically works. It lies dormant, he says. Well, in the Hebrew, it's not really dormant. He says, shemit almim, which means it's kind of concealed. In other words, it's in an altered state. So he's going to go now and explain what sight is on a human level, and then explain its analog on a spiritual level. Again, let me just be very clear what we're doing before we do it. He says, when a person is not feeling the powerful love, the natural love that the soul has for God inside, it means because on the outside, the relationship is not where it needs to be. And what is that state called? Sleep. What happens in sleep? Physically, three things he says. Sight is compromised, hearing is compromised, logic is compromised. Same thing happens spiritually when we sleep. and we're not doing what we need to do to create this, to maintain this relationship with God, our sight is compromised, our hearing is compromised, and our mind's logic, the logic is compromised as well. So what are these three things? Here we go. Number one, sight. What is sight? So he says, the power of sight is the ability to grasp the essence of an object. It's very important. As in the saying, hearing is not comparable to seeing. You know, there's a statement that we say, that's a Talmudic statement, 95, a Midrashic statement. Eina doima shmiler ear, you cannot compare hearing to seeing, another seeing is superior. But in English, we say something else. Seeing is believing. Seeing is believing. Simple way to understand this. I can tell you something, and you might believe it. But what happens if somebody else tells you something that contradicts what I said? You might say, well, Rabbi Ari's got to be right. Probably you won't say that. Probably in your mind, you'll have some doubt. Wait a second, so who's right? He told me this, she told me that. I don't know. I hear conflicting, you know, messages. When you see something, how many versions are there? You saw it. Somebody tells you you didn't see it. Thank you. I saw it. I know I saw it. I saw it. You can't tell me I didn't see it. So you can't. So the Talmud says, Eina doima shmiler ear. You cannot compare hearing to seeing. Hearing is so less powerful thing. It's so much weaker than seeing. So here we go. He explains that now on two different elements. When one first hears of a matter and understands it well, and subsequently one sees it, the matter becomes embedded within the soul in an entirely different way. Its very essence is then observed. So here we go. This is actually different than what I started explaining. What I started explaining before was actually the second point that he mentions. The first point is like this. Somebody describes to you, we've done this before, somebody describes to you a painting or a building. Someone says, oh my gosh, it's amazing. Oh, the new building, the new tower that they built in New York, the new, you know, Freedom Tower or whatever they call it, One World Trade Center. Gorgeous. It's tall and it's steel and it's glass and it's kind of twisted and you're trying to get a picture, and in your mind, when you hear this, if you've never seen it, so you're trying to imagine in your mind what it looks like, and you create a certain picture, but the picture is not accurate and there's got some holes in the picture because, you know, you don't know, because you're only hearing certain details and you don't have the whole picture. What happens when you see it? You have the essence of the building. You're not hearing it from the outside. It's like when you hear something, you kind of approach it from the outside. You get a little bit close. You start approaching it a little bit, and you have an idea. But when you see it, you get right into it. You see it, your eyes penetrate, you get the whole thing. So he says, the matter then becomes embedded within the soul in an entirely different way. Its very essence is then observed. This is a dimension not grasped earlier. Sight enables one to become attached to an object with all one's faculties and entire essence. So here he gets even deeper. When you hear something, you know, how much of an impression does it make on you? It can make an impression, but not the same as when you see it. When you see it, it becomes vivid. It becomes real. It's three-dimensional. It's not like a rumor or an idea. It's a reality. In addition, the second point, sight does not allow for obscurity and concealment. In other words, you cannot hide what you saw. Whereas through hearing, one grasps the matter on an intellectual level, leaving room for logical contradictions or alternate understandings. Seeing the essence and goodness of the matter makes it impossible for there to be any intellectual contradiction. So when you see something, no one can say you didn't see it. I saw it. I know I saw it. Whereas when you hear something, someone can say, no, you misunderstood. Or someone can say, whoever you heard that from was not telling you the truth. So, two kids come to you. One kid comes to you and says, not that this ever happens to me. One says, my brother hit me. Not from personal experience. And I say to him, wait a second. He hit you? Yeah. Why? No reason. He just hit me. Call the other one over. Why'd you hit your brother? Because he hit me. Who started it? Now what? Who's right? They don't back down, let's say. Each one maintains that the other one started the fight. Now what? Who's right? I don't know. You know why? Because I didn't see it. Because I'm hearing it. And hearing is very limited in its effectiveness. Hearing means I have a certain understanding or an awareness of something. But it's only limited. It's limited to the information. It's only as strong as the information or as the source of the information. So, and it's subject to contradiction. So first of all, I don't get a full picture of what actually happened, number one. Number two, it's susceptible to the story changing. It's not ironclad. Whereas when I see something, number one, I got the whole picture. Number two, you can't tell me that didn't happen. I just saw it. I know that today with Photoshop you can create something, you can see something that's not real. But my point is whatever you see at least is still there. Even if it's altered, it's still really altered. My point is when you see something, you see the whole thing, you see what it is, and you can't, it's not limited, it's not like something that you understood that can then be changed. It's something that you saw. Yeah.
So, I'm thinking about this a little bit differently in that when you're talking about seeing, you're seeing the actual events. But when you talk about hearing, you're talking about hearing about an event through another source.
Right.
But what we're doing when we're trying to learn is we're using both seeing and hearing, and what we're seeing is we're seeing words about something else, but we're going through one source to another source, whereas I could hear a car accident and know what I heard directly. That would be a direct hearing of what happened.
Right.
So it feels to me like you're kind of combining two different ideas and saying, well, hearing is this.
Right, so here's the thing.
Is that, but it's not a direct event versus an undirect event.
I'm with you. So what I would say is that learning and reading words on a paper is more hearing than seeing. Even if I'm looking, even if I'm seeing the words on the page, the totality of the experience is more hearing than seeing.
Right.
It's more hearing, he says, it's hearing and understanding. There was he connected those two things. Where does he do that? He says, yeah, whereas through hearing one grasps the matter on an intellectual level. So hearing is connected with understanding. So if you're using your mind to recreate the thing, then it's hearing. Even if you're seeing it.
Okay.
So even if you're looking at the words in the paper, but your mind is kind of, you know, working through the ideas, that's that. Now when you hear an accident, that sound is true to you. But you don't know exactly what happened or who caused it. In other words, there's still a truth to it that you might not have. At the same time, you know what you heard. So there is a directness there that you wouldn't have. In other words, I agree with you that there's shades of direct and indirect with both hearing and seeing. But typically, the experience of seeing something, like the example that I've given before, you walk into to a museum and you look at a piece of art and you see it. You see the whole thing. You see what it is. You get the core of what it is. And that's it. You saw it. Whereas somebody tells you that they went to this art gallery and they saw this beautiful painting and they describe it to you, that's a completely different experience. Because the image in that person's mind is different than the image that was on the wall that you saw. You saw the real thing. When you told me what you saw, I have now a recreation of that that's probably very far from that original painting. That's what I created in my mind. I will say that that's the same thing when we learn. Because the words and the ideas are the ideas, we then spin it in our own minds, and everyone has a different way of understanding it. That's what the Talmud says, that no two people think alike. Because everyone, even if it's the same information, everyone, the impression that it makes on the mind, on the brain, the way we understand it, is a little bit different. It's like the art is where it is, and then the transmission of that art is always a little bit different. And I know with seeing also, there's subtleties in how we see, and there's that question that everyone likes to ask, the philosophical question, how do we know that what I see is red is what you see is red? How do we know that we all see the colors the same? Right? Maybe I call red, you call blue, like that dress. Remember that dress? Anyway, yes.
So I get the teaching, I understand the teaching, but you know, I see an exception, like with music or sound, beautiful sounds of nature. I mean, you can't, you know, then hearing trumps sight.
Correct. Hearing is very powerful. What we're doing here is different here. What we're doing here is not necessarily denigrating hearing altogether, but pointing out an area in which sight surpasses hearing. Hearing will have its day and its page. We'll get to hearing soon. But for right now, the advantage of sight over sound is that sight is more direct and less susceptible to concealment and contradiction than is sound. You're right, if you want to go to a concert or a symphony, the main experience is the sound. You can close your eyes and just hear and feel the music envelop you without watching the musicians actually go and play. And you can have that deep experience. Does the visual help? Yeah, but you're right. The hearing is the bigger part of that experience. So this is not saying that in every situation sight is better than hearing, and hearing is, you know, second-class citizen. What it means is simply, in the sense of what creates a true impression and you know, reality and validity, sight typically is more powerful than sound. Now, what does this mean spiritually? So let's take a look, bottom half of page 70, and he now brings it back to the spiritual analog. So looking at, again, remember, there's three steps here. We look at sleep. You know, so what is sleep? Sleep is where your sight is compromised, and your hearing, and your logic is compromised, but we're starting with sight. So your sight is compromised. Well, what is sight? Step two. So sleeping, your sight is compromised. Well, what is sight? Sight is seeing into something, really seeing and observing what it is in a way that's you're really connected with it. So what's spiritual sight? Step three. Here we go. On a spiritual level, sight corresponds to chachma. Chachma is wisdom. Seeing the essence of godliness. So for the soul, sight means you're seeing godliness. As in the quote from our sages, Pirkei Avot. No, not even. From the Talmud, Tractate Tamid. Says, who is a wise man? One who foresees dot, dot, dot. Why does it say dot, dot, dot? I'll tell you the rest of it. I don't know why they left it out. Just the original left it out. It says, Ezehu chacham. Who is a wise person? A chacham. Chachma. Chacham. Who's wise? Haroe et hanolad. One who sees what is yet to be born. So the Talmud defines wisdom as being able to see what has not yet happened. In other words, being able to see a little bit down the line, not just what's right in front of you, but able to see. Someone who's wise is someone who's thinking several steps in advance. If I do this, what are the repercussions? Is this a wise move? What are the effects? What are the consequences? And then act accordingly. So again, who is wise? One who foresees. On this level, godliness is truly embedded within the soul. When you see godliness, it's real, it's true, it's embedded within the soul, causing a genuine attachment to God which can neither be concealed nor severed. And now he says, he pinpoints an era in Jewish history in which the collective community at large had this experience of spiritual sight. During the era of the Holy Temple, the Jewish people experienced spirituality on this level. As the verse states, three times a year, all your menfolk shall appear. Just as one came to see, one came to be seen. Let me explain this. The Torah says, it says in the Bible, says that there are three festivals annually that the Jewish nation should make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem and the Holy Temple for. They are Sukkot, the festival of the booths, tabernacle, whatever it is, Sukkot, Passover, Pesach, and Shavuot, the holiday that's coming up in a few weeks. Three times a year, known as the Shalosh Regalim, the three festivals, these are the big three, that everyone would come. They would leave their small towns and villages and farms, and they would come. The mitzvah was only incumbent on the men, understanding that sometimes women and children could not travel. So you can't make a commandment obligatory if the person is not able to do it. So therefore, women were encouraged to come, but they were not obligated. Hence the menfolk, which I think is a weird phrase, but in the English. Anyway, but hence that detail in the verse. The bottom line is, the Torah says, Yera'eh, they shall appear. But it means like see. And the Talmud says, what does it mean they shall appear? They should be seen and they should see. Or they should see and be seen. Be seen, what does that mean? You should be there in the temple on the holiday so that God sees that you showed up. And what are you seeing? Because it says you see and you're seen. So you're seen there, you know. But what are you seeing? You're seeing godliness. You're seeing spirituality at the temple experience. That's what he says. This experience, when you went to the Holy Temple back in the day, I mean, it's such a foreign thing for us because it's been a while. It's been 2,000 years, right? We don't know this stuff. They used to see daily, the Talmud says, 10 miracles a day happened. Daily stuff. You walked in, it was a transcendent place. It was a holy place. You might wonder, how did they ever go off the rails and not do what God wanted? And how were the temples ever destroyed? That's a good question. But you need to know that when you went into the temple, you were transformed. You saw things that just absolutely impacted you. And that's what he says. Because you saw God, that affected you in a deep way. This experience engendered inner self-nullification expressed by page, now we turn the page to 72, prostrating oneself before God, which is an expression of total self-nullification. They used to bow down in the temple, you know, some synagogues, including here, on the high holidays, there are certain times where you bow down. It's called prostrating oneself, where, you know, just bow down, your head down to the ground, bowing down to God. In the temple, it was more common. You know, in synagogues around the world, it's typically Rosh Hashanah, maybe Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. They do this a few times in the service. But in the temple, it was a daily experience. The sight itself, seeing God in the temple, so to speak, seeing godliness in the temple, that evoked that sense of total self-nullification. And self-nullification, in other words, you see that, and you don't exist anymore in that moment. It's like you're totally taken by that experience, and that's expressed by just giving oneself over to God, so to speak, physically.
So, Duchenim.
No, that's different. That's the blessing. That's the blessing that the Kohanim give, that the priests give to the congregation. But that wasn't the bowing down.
Okay.
Yeah. The bowing down was before God. This is explained in, oh, so now he cites a reference. This is explained in Likutei Torah, discourse beginning by Yom HaShmini Atzeret, the discourse discussing how a wise son delights his father. Okay, whatever. So that's where he puts like a reference in the text itself. Thus we say in the prayers for the holidays, we say like this. This is an excerpt, but there's a larger prayer. The prayer says like this. The prayer on the holiday, we talk about the offerings that were brought in the temple and the experience of the temple, and then we say, but because of our sins, galinu me'artzenu, we were exiled from our land, v'nisrachaknu me'al masenu, and we were distanced from our land, ve'ein anu yecholim lirais u'lishtachavais. And we cannot see nor bow. That's what we say in the prayers. In other words, we no longer today have a temple. We say in the prayers that this is what we used to, this is how we used to observe the holiday through the various offerings. Today we don't have a temple, so therefore instead we're offering these prayers to you. But part of that terminology is ve'ein anu yechelim lira. We are not able to appear and bow, which at first glance seems puzzling back inside. Why are we unable to bow? This is because One is dependent on the other. Only by seeing godliness can one experience self-nullification expressed through prostration, which is an inner self-nullification. This was experienced during the Holy Temple era while fulfilling the mitzvah of appearing and seeing, and it lasted throughout the year. In other words, having seen that temple experience, it created an impression on a person that then lasted throughout the year, and it created this inner sense of self-nullification. So what's the point? Today, when we don't have a temple, we can't see God on that level, so we also don't have that dedication to God either. This is called sleeping in exile. Ani Yeshena, King Solomon writes in Song of Songs, I am sleeping. And the Zohar says, Begalusa, in exile in Galus, what does that mean? It means that in the time of exile, we don't have the ability to see God because we're sleeping. And therefore, since we can't see, we don't have the sense of total self-nullification to God. We don't have that sense of dedication because we don't see that truth. Does it make sense? Okay. What about hearing? Okay, spiritual hearing. The level of hearing, however, corresponds to understanding. Exactly what we talked about before. Hearing is understanding. Again, seeing is when something becomes clear and it becomes ingrained, and therefore it affects how you are inside. It affects your state of being to the point that when one saw God, one lost the ability to stand up proud. You cannot stand up and say, oh, look, here's godliness and here I am. You're on the ground. Not the whole time, but you have an experience of, wow. You lose yourself. Because God is here. You see God. You hear about God. You don't go to the ground. You're heard. It doesn't create the same impression. So here we get to hearing. The level of hearing, however, corresponds to understanding, which, he says, was also experienced during the Holy Temple era, when there was a full and in-depth good understanding of godliness. In other words, back in the day, people also, not only did they see God when they went to the temple, but they also, at that time, they also had a better understanding of the spiritual, of the mystical, of the godly. Indeed, the higher level of sight is attained, doesn't mean higher level of sight, like there's two levels of sight, but sight itself is attained through comprehension. This, now he mixes the two. He says, not only are there two different levels of seeing and hearing, but he says you can get to seeing through hearing. By using the mind to delve into the depths of an idea, a degree of certainty associated with sight can be attained, as explained elsewhere. In other words, you can actually almost get a sense of sight from hearing if you really understand something well. If you really understand something well, it's almost like you can see it. That's if you really understand it well. Typically, we don't understand things that well, and we're kind of more like on the outside, on the periphery of an idea. But if you really have a true level of hearing like they had in the time of the temple, then that itself leads to seeing. So they had the physical seeing, they had the hearing, the understanding, they saw godliness, they understood godliness, they understood so much that that understanding could also be considered on some level a seeing. And that's what they had at the time of the temple. Let's talk about now in exile. Spiritual sleep, bottom of 72. During the time of exile, however, I am asleep in exile. And the 74, and the quality of sight is not present at all, except in lofty souls. So, you and I, we don't see God, typically. We don't see godliness on a regular basis. That doesn't happen. We see other things, except for in lofty souls, which even during exile are free from the constraints of the exile. So there are some that even though there's no temple, to them it's like they're in the temple era. It's like they're in this time of spiritual awakeness. But for most of us, we don't see God. All that can be experienced in exile is the level of hearing and understanding, which, when properly utilized, allows for proper understanding of spirituality and, consequently, true love and awe of God. So the best we can hope for is hearing and understanding. It's like the what the Berditchever said to God once when he was praying. He said, this is Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Berditchever. He was known to be an advocate for the Jewish people. He was always finding some goodness to talk about his fellow Jew. And he said once to God, don't judge your people harshly, he said. Understand that you stack the deck against us. You've made it difficult for us. You've put all of the worldly things in front of our eyes, and all the spiritual matters you put away in the books, on the shelf, right? All the discussions about God and purpose and truth and, you know, Torah and mitzvot, it's all in the books. And what's in front of us? Sushi. And herring. And bagels and cream cheese. That's what we see. And we're creatures of the visual. So that's what creates an impression. So he says, what is this? You do it the other way around. Put spirituality in front of our eyes. And put all of the distractions in the books. Put a suit, you know, have a volume of, you know, the art of sushi in a book. But no sushi in front of it. And put all this stuff in the book. And we'll see how people would be on board with you and spirituality and purpose and meaning. This is the state that we live in. What we see is not God. We don't live in the times of the temple. The best we can do is try to hear or understand godly matters. That's the best we can do. But even that could be in a state of sleep, which we'll talk about next week. So, actually, not next week. I don't think next week. We may be off. Okay, let me just wrap it up and then we'll talk about next week. So, bottom line, what did we learn today? So today we spoke about sleep, and we said that sleep is a state of altered consciousness. There is a consciousness, but it's altered. And unlike when we're awake, where there's a hierarchy and things make sense and things are orderly, when we sleep, things are a bit chaotic and a bit chalenty, a bit mixed up. That could be an advantage. The advantage is that we're not constrained by our normal thought patterns or logic patterns, so we can imagine and we can express ourselves and get to know ourselves better than we do when we're stuck in a box. That's the advantage. There are disadvantages as well in that we're not, you know, thinking in the way that we should be thinking, perhaps. Kabbalah uses sleep and dreaming as an analogy to a non-desirable state of spiritual being, where a person is not consciously thinking about the right things, thinking about purpose and meaning, but rather being distracted. So this is the analogy of sleep. And we explain that sleep specifically has a few elements. Number one, sleep compromises a few elements, including sight, sound, seeing, hearing, and understanding. And the same thing is true when we sleep spiritually. Our vision of truth is compromised, our hearing of truth is compromised, and our understanding of truth is likewise compromised. And this will lead us into a discussion about how to get out of sleep, and then we'll flip it to see the power of sleep. That's it for today. Thank you very much for joining me for Kabbalah and Coffee.